So Jacob and Esau are people that we're talking about or understanding their story today. They had a very complicated relationship. They shared the womb. And in Genesis, Rebecca is recorded as having said that they fought so much in her womb that she wanted to die. They were always going, "You're in my space." So back then, when the firstborn child, firstborn son, always had the birthright to inherit his father's entire estate. And so Esau was firstborn and he would inherit. Then there was a time as kids when Esau was hungry and Jacob had made soup and he said he would sell him his birthright for a bowl of soup. And so there's always this tension about who's going to really inherit. And Esau really would have been Isaac's choice. But Rebecca was complicit, that's the mother, in deceiving Isaac into believing he was blessing Esau when he actually blessed Jacob. Remember that story about how they put lamb's wool on his hands because Esau was a hairy man, and so that he would think he was blessing his oldest son. Now, Rebecca's Armenian. She's sister to Laban. So the way that things happened, because Jacob got the blessing, Esau had to make his own way in life. And Jacob had the family fortune. But there was a tragedy that happened kind of in that country in terms of everybody was starving and Jacob really lost the family fortune. And so he decided to go and work for Uncle Laban. And they made an agreement that he would work for him for 7 years to be able to marry Rachel, his second daughter. But on his wedding night, he discovered that he hadn't married Rachel. He'd married Leah. And so he confronted Laban. "Why did you do this to me? We had an agreement." And Laban said, "I can't let my second daughter marry before my first daughter's married." So you see, tricksters kind of run in this family. So Jacob said, "Okay, I'll work another 7 years for the right to marry Rachel," which he then did. And then there was tension between the sisters because Leah had bore children for Jacob and Rachel had not. So they had this tension. And then the other thing that had been going on for all these years is that Jacob was making himself a wealthy man at Laban's expense. And so Laban's sons were catching on to this. And they were after him. And so he knew he had to get out of there. And so where did he choose to go? But to his brother, who was also, that's another hotbed. Frankly, this family kind of makes mine look mild. But that's where we pick up the story today, is that, okay, so he's left, and he's going to go meet his brother, and he's afraid. And what he's afraid is, how can, with all the cheating and deceiving that's been going on in this family, how can I make peace with my brother? How can I make things right? And so he's come up with some pretty elaborate gifts. How can the sins against the family be restored, be reconciled? You know, with the history of this family, it could be pretty tough. And it strikes me that, you know, as we look at what's going on in our country today, we're a divided country. How can we in this country find some reconciliation? I've often wondered how the United States can heal the sins of slavery. Jacob was trying to buy his brother's forgiveness. So would reparations help? Would that work to heal the wounds? If so, how does one establish a price for having owned another human being? And considering this was a century and a half ago, how do we begin to make restorative justice? I'd like to talk about a way that a lot of people think justice can happen. And that's called an inverted kingdom. So it's not enough to be freed from slavery, I need for you to be a slave to me. I was your slave, now you have to be my slave. That's an inverted kingdom. You oppress me, now I get to oppress you. And if I don't get a turn at being the oppressor, then we can't have equality. Because we didn't have the same experience, did we? Inverted kingdoms. Last Sunday we were playing cards with Craig's mother and I was losing. So I whispered to Craig, I'd like an inverted kingdom. And I wanted to go from losing to winning. And ironically, I did win. A few years ago, an Orthodox rabbi was a student of mine. At the same time that a Palestinian Muslim was a student of mine. And they both had family in Jerusalem. And it was very difficult for the rabbi because he kept thinking that his peer was the enemy. His family may be hurting my family. And so I invited them to talk about peace. What would it mean? How can you do that? And the rabbi said, we don't want peace. We want power. Inverted kingdom. In an inverted kingdom, the system doesn't change. Just the players change roles. Would that be restorative justice? There's another dynamic in our society that I think plays into this struggle. At least it does for me. I want to talk about superiority, inferiority. This is a concept that's so ingrained into our culture that we often don't even recognize it. We often size people up, assessing if we are superior or they're superior. We can feel superior about our intellect or about our degrees or our jobs or our income or what we drive or our church donations and on and on and on. There's lots of ways in which we end up trying to decide, are we superior to someone else? And in the last couple of years, there's been a rise in white supremacy that's been endorsed, and there's this great divide. There have been people who have been working in the White House who have been saying that our president wants to create a race war. Superior, inferior. I remember telling someone that I'm a UCC clergy, and that person said, oh, they let anybody in. I felt the knife. I felt the superiority. And then I said, that's the point, isn't it? Now, I got to feel superior for a moment. About 40 years ago, my then wife and I went to a marriage encounter weekend, and in an attempt to save our marriage. And no one was allowed to ask, what was your employment? What do you do? What's your job? You couldn't tell what yours was, and you couldn't ask anybody what they did. Why? Because people categorize others based on work. How many times when you meet someone for the very first time do they ask, what do you do? So Craig talks about answering now, I'm retired. And then there's this confused look on their face in terms of, well, I don't know how to categorize that. You have to tell me more about you. I keep telling people that superiority, inferiority thinking will not serve us well in moving toward equality and restorative justice. Anything that I feel superior about serves to separate us, not unite us. And inferiority works the same way. Restorative has to do with healing. What will it take to heal? We must stop measuring ourselves by other people. We can't decide our worth by comparing ourselves to others. We're all different. But our differences do not make us better or worse than the other. I think Jesus gave us a model for restorative justice. So I'd like to ask Chris to play a song. It's just a minute and 51 seconds. But I want you to think about what feelings come up in that when you hear that song.
Grace is true, God will save you, and all the Jews and Hitler too. Those with an overflowing cup, and those who want to blow us up. All little children will get in with those who stole their innocence, who once were children just like them, and will be children once again. But we know grace is not fair, and that is something we can't bear. So we take eternal truth and snuff it out. That's what we do. Replace it with a temporal flame, one that we control and tame. And here's the rub, though we have stayed and say we've kept the narrow way and kept the unclean ones away, God welcomes us in any way. If grace is true,
I'd like you to take just a moment to think of one word feeling. Just one word. What feeling came up for you when you heard that song? I'm not going to ask you to share it. I just want you to be aware of it. The first time I heard that song, I was angry. Angry that God could love my father, who had been so abusive to me. I didn't want God to love him, but I knew he did. The second time I heard the song, I was repentant. I'm grateful that God can love me, even when I have been so judgmental and angry about those who God chooses to love. The only way that I can see through to restorative justice is not with a price, not with 200 sheep and 20 cows and whatever, but with a promise to not be that way anymore. The way to restorative justice is to rely on the grace of God. Amen.
Reverend Hochul is also a family systems therapist, and this story is really a good example of messed up family dynamics, right? And he was, before he retired, also a supervisor, a chaplaincy supervisor. And now he's retired and is worthy. Yeah, thank you, Dean. That was really great.